I once had a father-in-law who would always tell me, there is no such thing as a short, bad sermon. And I can tell many of you wholeheartedly agree. Thanks, choir. And as I struggled putting this sermon together this week, what I realized is that the sermon is about normal length of most sermons that I preach. The problem is that the introduction is a lot longer. So in my own defense, I obviously am asking for forgiveness, not permission. But I hope to address building more positive relationships between Christians and Muslims. And whenever you seek to take on a more complex kind of topic, well, it's like building a wonderful, beautiful skyscraper. Before you can go up, 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 you have to dig deep, deep down. So I have four preliminary points. So bear with me. Point number one. This is a critical issue for our times. One in every three persons on earth is a Christian. One in every five persons on earth is a Muslim. Meaning, combined, our two faiths comprise over half of the world's religion, or of the world's population. And Muslims don't merely live on the other side of the planet. They are our neighbors. We work with them here in this community. Many of them are our children's best friends. More than once, someone has said to me, after hearing about my interfaith work, I know some Muslims. They're some of the finest, nicest people I have ever met. Point number two. Despite these intersections, there exists an enormous gulf of misunderstanding and an inordinate amount of fear and misunderstanding between our two groups. Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." But working toward peace is never easy. Peace is born from a serious and rigorous effort toward authentic dialogue. And our duty as peacemakers, as Christians seeking to follow the Christ who is the Prince of Peace, is to work at solutions beyond political stereotypes and sound bites, past troubling historical divisions, as we truly seek to listen to one another and attempt to understand each other from the heart. For over 1,500 years, Christians and Muslims have lived side by side, sometimes with peace and great success, and sometimes with terrible great divisions. Conflict leading to bloodshed has been a very real part of this interaction. And at times, Christians have been just as brutal and immoral as the evil we say we oppose. But warfare and terrorism is not about one specific religion. It is about the perversion of using religion wrongly. A Muslim terrorist is no more validated by the normative teachings of Islam for an act of terror than a Christian might be validated by our own faith for doing the very same thing. Perhaps we should remember, more Muslims are killed by Muslim terrorism than by any other group. Terrorism is a problem for them as much as it is for us. And we can either fight terrorism together Or we can let terrorism be victorious by tearing us apart. It is the purpose of evil to twist the teachings of our great faiths toward a feeding frenzy that leads to war. That's why diplomats and Christians seeking to be peacemakers must be courageous people. We must fight the fear with our faith and speak the truth with boldness, pointing out places where we are together and in agreement, and also, frankly, places where we are in disagreement. I can't tell you how many times in my 20-plus years of talking to Muslims that after 10 or 15 minutes of conversation, I learned how many misunderstandings exist between us. Things I thought they believed and things they thought I believed, held in error by each of us because we simply haven't spent the time to get to know the true answer and to speak with our neighbor. We've been too afraid. And our fear just fuels the frenzy. And then, once you add religion to this toxic mix, it's like pouring gasoline on a raging fire. Number three, this need toward more positive Christian and Muslim relationships is not just a contemporary challenge. As evidenced by our Bible reading today, the Muslim story of faith is akin to our own. The three Abrahamic faiths, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are all rooted in a common and robust heritage of a people who desire to live faithfully and morally in right relationship to the one true God. Someday, we might discover that it has been a form of blasphemy to use our different approaches to God as a form of division within the family of God. I point to one work, an English translation of the Quran with commentator from a Christian, finding over 3,000 parallelisms between the Bible and the Quran in a split-page format. Yes, there are differences, but let us not forget or neglect the many numerous similarities. Finally, I must recommend and acknowledge the work of Yale theologian Miroslav Volf in his book, Allah, A Christian Response. You'll notice excerpts from that book in your worship bulletin today. The main point of his book is to answer a pressing question that, believe it or not, I won't have time to address in this sermon. Thank you, Greg. I heard that. I recognize that voice. The question is, do we worship the same God? And if you've ever tried to struggle with the Jewish and Muslim understanding of monotheism next to the Christian confession of the Trinity, read the book. Get the book. It has influenced my thinking and will continue to influence my thinking. And even if you need to learn a little bit about the Christian confession of the Trinity, it's a good place to start if you haven't wrestled with those issues. We are Baptist. Historic Baptist. Baptists who have always stood strong for this treasured heritage of religious freedom, where all forms of religious bigotry and discrimination are wrong and ultimately damaging to the cause of Christ in the world. Whenever one specific group is singled out in front of all the rest as exceptionally threatening or immoral, it's not just humiliating and shaming and stigmatizing upon them. Such attitudes and actions invite average citizens and uncritical believers to marginalize, mistreat, and at times violently abuse members of the targeted group. We've seen it time and time again. We've seen it with the African American community who some say, are often held accountable while driving under the influence of being a minority. We've seen it with Japanese Americans who were forcefully interned during World War II. We've seen it with LGBTQ friends and family members who have had their very survival and their most basic daily needs called into question. Religion is a place to mend fences and build bridges, not to divide communities. Because before you know it, when we use our religion as a means of hatred and condemnation for our neighbor, even our neighbor who is different, then every single person, the oppressed and the oppressor, become victimized by such victimization, such torment, such scourging. These are difficult times. These are serious times. And these are hopeful times. And not just because the introduction is over. No, because we turn to this story, this ancient, incredible, surprising, life-giving story that we have read from Genesis. Most, I imagine, know the bare bones of this story. Abraham, the foremost patriarch, father to Isaac, grandfather to Jacob, and the promised formation of the chosen, was promised by God to be the father of a line of descendants as numerous as the stars. Yet together with Sarah, his favorite wife, they suffered barrenness, not blessedness. Living as they were in a culture that viewed the value of women primarily as vehicles for procreation, featuring masculine command and fertile necessity, it was customary for a man to father children by many different women, something Abraham did with at least 9 named sons with 4 different women. We know the familiar ones. Isaac, son of Sarah. Ishmael, son of Hagar. But there's also Zimron, and Jashkan, and Medan, and Midian, and Jisbak, and Shua, all sons of Keturah, Genesis 25, 1 through 2. I offer those names, Zimron, Jashkan, Jisbak, just in case you're looking for a novel biblical name for a future birth. These are not characters in Star Trek on a different planet somewhere in a galaxy far, far away. That's Star Wars, I know. I'm trying to mix things up here. Biblical names. Abraham's sons. According to some biblical scholars, Abraham's literal firstborn son was Eleazar, son of Mazak, Genesis 15:2. Some have quipped that indeed Abraham had a focus on the family, though it was a lot different than James Dobson's focus and the founding member had in mind. And should I mention that any of the daughters who were named in these unions are unnamed in the biblical record? Yes, Father Abraham had many sons, as we sang about at camp growing up. But certainly, Abraham had many daughters too. This morning, we're focused on a woman who is the daughter of a nameless father. Her name, Hagar. An Egyptian handmaid of Sarah's, a person better thought of as a slave, making her a unique and special nominee to be a biblical heroine and saint, as pointed out by many womanist Christian scholars. And while the text doesn't reveal much about her, we are aware of Hagar's powerlessness in this whole situation. how Sarah's jealousy and suspicion about Hagar and her son overwhelm good moral reasoning once Isaac is born, and how Abraham becomes conflicted and complicit in a failed effort to judge his competing loyalties. And this is one of those places when we read the Bible, we should pause and appreciate how sometimes the Scriptures just drip with irony. Here he is, the powerful, historically significant Abraham. Doesn't it seem incredible, even comical, how he is scrambling around, browbeaten and bullied into a corner with a command to banish Hagar and her son, his son, into the wilderness? We should remind ourselves, the older generation, we should always tell the younger generation, if those in power are not compelled with the responsibility of the power they bear to use it fairly and legitimately, then we, the people of God, who ascribe to a higher authority, have the right and the responsibility to call them out, to demand justice, to demand fairness, to say that they serve the common good, not themselves, and for anyone to use their position of power as permission for their own selfish indulgence is an abuse of the power in which that has been entrusted to them. Moses stood up to Pharaoh. Jesus stood up to Herod and Pilate. And Abraham and Sarah are reprehensible in how they use their power to condemn and exclude the powerless, even when human life is at risk, even when it includes their own community, even when it includes their own family. And then perhaps Abraham's conscience is eased in the text, having God say, it's okay, let him go, I'll take care of him, do what Sarah asks. Unfortunately, this is not the only example in world history or in biblical record where someone uses God's name to rationalize their own inexcusable behavior. And we should grow tired of counting all the other times someone has slapped God's name upon their shameful acts in an effort to make it appear more noble. So we must read with careful discernment, searching as we must for the deeper will and wisdom of God. And as often the case in our own personal experiences, we can look back upon a previous difficult situation where we thought God was absent and say to ourselves, no, God was providing for me. I just found that in an unrecognizable form in the time in which I was living through it. So I cannot imagine the desperation felt by Hagar and her child. I've been protected, perhaps you have too, from never knowing that despair and anxiety. How difficult that must feel to have your own child in your arms and not to be able to care for that child and to even have to hold them in their suffering when they're starving and thirsty and soon to die. It's too much to bear. It's too much for Hagar. She places her nearly dead child in the shade, knowing that she cannot bear to witness his final breath. What are we to make of this terrible moment? The clue is in the name Ishmael, meaning God hears. Strangely, throughout this story, his name has been absent in the telling throughout this whole ordeal. Perhaps it's to emphasize all the nameless souls banished and forgotten that only God hears. How God hears the cries of the outcast and the abandoned. God hears and has compassion for them. How God is the God of the lonely and the least and the lost. By the intervention of the Lord, Ishmael and his mother survive. He grows up in the wilderness and becomes the father of a great nation, the Ishmaelites. He also becomes the father-in-law of Esau, another overlooked son in the Bible. God was with the boy, the outcast son of Abraham. God was with his mother, Hagar, the Egyptian slave woman cast out by the father of her child. Hagar's name also presents a clue, for she offers one of the earliest names for God, El Rai, the God who sees me, the God who I see, and the God who pays attention to me. In the Qumran, Ishmael is seen as a prophet, the keeper of promise, the messenger of Allah. He is enjoined upon his people, worship with almsgiving and giving acceptable homage in the sight of the Lord. Some of you may be familiar with the Hajj, one of the five pillars of Islam. It is a religious pilgrimage that every Muslim hopes to take to Mecca once in their lifetime. And during that celebrated week, held annually, there are certain things that pilgrims do as a part of the Hajj. One is to walk around the Kaaba 7 times, that large cubic structure. The heritage is built by Adam and rebuilt by Abraham. And 7 times the devotees go around the Hajj in this mass assemblage. And then right after they finish going around the Kaaba, they go to 2 small hills nearby where there's the holy well of Zamza, a place to commemorate the well that God provided to take care of Hagar and Ishmael. For 7 times, the devotees run up and down the hill in this frantic search of water for the starving and sickly son. Most believe this Islamic version parallels Moses' story being hid in the bushes by his family to escape the death of Pharaoh. Or in our tradition, Mary and Joseph taking baby Jesus away from King Herod before he slaughters the innocents. That each of these three faiths have stories of God caring for the vulnerable, for children, for those who have no advocacy. Each of them, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim, make this claim for the vulnerable. God hears. God sees. God cares. And God will deliver. So, let me wrap this up. I know pizza's coming. God is watching and knowing how we, the Christians, are treating our Muslim neighbors in this country and around the world. Could we be viewed like Abraham and Sarah as children of promise and privilege and power, who turn a blind eye and a cold heart to the plight of the suffering? Are we ruled more by our fear and prejudice of them, with exclusive concentration on our own well-being, than by any concern we might have for suffering and starving children of Syria or Iraq? Do we look with indifference upon our Muslim neighbors, even here in the Lexington community, who simply wish to have a place to exercise their religion and grow their families and be good citizens and have a living made well? Have we engaged them in welcome and kindness, conversation, coffee, friendship, inclusion? Do we offer the compassion and care of Christ to pray for peace and to work toward peace in order to build bridges of mutual respect and support? Or we just say the problems are too big? What can one person do? Can we learn from one another's understanding of the divine and how we can live more faithfully and morally together as an a unified community of inclusion and grace. All together, we are building a dwelling place. God hears. God sees. God cares. And in God's time, and alongside now our willing participation, God will deliver. Let us pray.